I watched a lovely young woman die a horrific, painful death.
She should have thought about that before she had sex.
Oh, you'd condemn her to death for that mistake, would you? Well, you've never had sex when you weren't expecting to. Well, no, in your case, probably not. These things happen. As doctors, we know that. Now, you can sit in your smug backsides and do nothing, and women will die. Or we can push the AMA to pressure the government to change the law.
And change the Victorian law he eventually did, but not without risking his own life and after a ferocious battle. The words of the late Dr. Bertram Weiner there, addressing fellow members of the Australian Medical Association, about a young woman dying after a backyard abortion. This was Melbourne in the late 1960s. To have an abortion or to conduct one was illegal and subject to a heavy sentence. It was around this time a young student activist named Jo attended the inaugural meeting of the Abortion Law Reform Association. What she didn't yet realise, though, that this would take her, along with Dr. Weiner, down what was to be a dangerous path that would turn the Victorian police force on its head. On Sunday night, ABC One is going to screen a telemovie about their story called Dangerous Remedy, with a powerful performance by Jeremy Sims as Dr. Weiner, along with Susie Porter, William McGuinness, Gary Sweet and others. Joining me on Life Matters this morning is Dr. Jo Weiner, a social scientist, an eminent women's health researcher, and Bertram Weiner's widow and collaborator. Welcome, Jo.
Thanks very much, Natasha.
Gee, this is a compelling telemovie, I have to say. Probably less than compelling time for you. This was a time, if we head back to the story that it tells, your story, this was a time when abortion really was not spoken about in public. And we have to say that to a great extent it still isn't. It remains a very sensitive issue for many, even those who identify as pro-choice. But what was the attitude back then?
Well, I worked with ABC Television Current Affairs at the time, and we couldn't even use the word abortion in the media. There were about 9 or 10 different euphemisms, an illegal operation, and many others. Mm. So it was impossible to even use the word, and it wasn't until the inquiry that was forced by Bert that the headline writers for the newspapers found that they couldn't write big enough type on the front page, and so they started using the word abortion. It was absolutely below the level of consciousness, and there was an impermeable barrier between public discourse and the reality of women's lives.
And the reality of women's lives, well, this is, what were the conditions and consequences at the time for women seeking to terminate a pregnancy?
Well, this precedes the single mother's pension support benefit. And so when women became pregnant, it was always entirely their fault, according to public discourse, so that women were taught the phrase, you know, I went out and got myself pregnant. I've always been very puzzled about how women could be convinced that this was something that they did on their own. But certainly they bore the consequences more heavily than their male partners. Many men, of course, were beautiful and looked after their women as best as they could. And the role of men in those days was to find someone who would do the abortion. So there was total social opprobrium for women who were pregnant outside marriage. And, of course, many women, it didn't stop women having sexual activity and they became pregnant. This is not very long after the oral contraceptive was introduced.
What were the options for women who did seek determination? Because there were a couple of different avenues, weren't there?
Our capital cities all out. Our capital cities all had similar systems, and that is at the top layer of the system were the gynaecologists. And if you're a middle-class woman and could afford the fee, your doctor might refer you to a gynaecologist and you'd have a safe abortion in a private hospital and be called something else, a D&C or something, a curette. Below those were the professional abortionists, and these were doctors who had made a decision to develop their skills. They were usually either general practitioners or gynaecologists, and they operated completely outside the law and usually overwhelmingly by paying graft to police to be allowed to continue to operate. Below that were the backyard abortionists, and these were people, some of whom might have had nursing or medical training in other countries.
If that.
Many of them didn't. One of our more infamous ones, Charlie Wyatt, was a butcher by trade. And he was trained by a doctor how to do it. He operated on the kitchen tables of various crime gang members in Footscray. And he's depicted in the film.
He sure is.
And below that were the most neighbourhoods had their own woman who gave advice and sometimes, you know, gave drugs and so on to help women. And at the very bottom of the scale were women trying to self-induce abortions. And they would do that by taking green label pills, which were a laxative, anything that said on it, do not take during pregnancy. Drink a bottle of gin, have hot baths. These are very real things that women did. Try and evacuate the uterus with a coat hanger or anything else that they could get through the cervix, jumping from heights. It was absolutely barbaric.
There was a whole ward in the Royal Women's Hospital.
Yes, a 32-bed ward that was devoted to women who had been brutalised and harmed and injured through these backyard processes. I'd have to say the doctors were very skilled and very few of their patients ended up there. But they, along with that ward, was a ward set aside for the women who were dying. And if a woman was dying, the hospital was obliged to call the police because the dying deposition was enough to convict somebody. They didn't need any other evidence. And so a woman's dying from the result of backyard abortion, so she's got septicemia, gangrene, whatever. And she's, instead of having her family around her and, you know, the transition, she's got a police officer shaking her saying, you know, tell us who did it, love.
Yeah,
it was. We cannot imagine the brutality that is part of our grandmothers and our mothers. I mean, well, I'm old enough. I'm only 66, and this was my lived reality too.
Yeah, and the Royal Women's. I was born there not long after all this time, I have to say. So it's a pretty powerful reflection for me too. So tell us about how you joined forces with Dr. Bertram Wainer, a Glaswegian GP with a practice in St Kilda, because you talk about all this now in hindsight as something that we know, but in fact it was your collaboration with him that unearthed what was effectively corruption in the police force.
Yes, well, as the journalist Devon Witten put it, when you're in the homicide squad, there aren't very many kind of ways to shake down the victims because they're all dead. Most of the police units at that time, you know, had their ways of supplementing their income through graft, the gaming squad and, you know, the prostitution and so on. You could all shake down the victims. But in the homicide squad didn't have much and their only earner was abortion.
So how'd you meet Bert?
I was the inaugural secretary of the Abortion Law Reform Association. Little did I know that that was going to be something that, you know, directed a lot of my life when I volunteered as a student at Melbourne University. And he joined the association. We used to meet at my father's house in South Yarra. We lived opposite the Lieutenant Governor at the time and all sorts of things went on there, but in that house. But one of them was the meetings of the Abortion Law Reform Association, and Bert joined. And after a couple of meetings, he said, look, I think we should just do a test case. And we all looked at him and said, you can't do that. That's illegal. And he said, that's the point, at which time I was delegated to go and sack him from the association for being too outrageous.
But you did a test case, didn't you?
Well, he did. Yeah, he did three, actually. And this followed the acquittal of Dr. Ken Davidson, who was the first doctor in Victoria charged with unlawful abortion, and Justice Menhinnett had to give a ruling to the jury as to what was lawful.
And that ruling actually has defined the landscape in Australia ever since, hasn't it? Just briefly,
yes.
Before we want to head back to the story briefly, but what was that ruling and why was it so significant?
It said that you can only convict somebody if they'd done an unlawful abortion, so that's in the Crimes Act, and so that he had to direct what was lawful. And he said it's lawful to terminate a pregnancy if it's to protect a woman's life or physical or mental health. And so nobody knew what that meant. And so Bert did three test cases, each one with a different indication of escalating or de-escalating, actually, significance. So the first one was life-threatening. The second one was considerable risk. And the third one was a woman who had multiple pregnancies and couldn't handle another one. And that was to demonstrate to doctors that it was safe for them to do abortions.
And it set a precedent which has sustained since. Yeah. But back to the corruption that was going on. What did you, with Bert, with your boyfriend at the time, Lionel Pugh, who in fact eventually took his life,
killed.
Allegedly.
No, he didn't take his life. He was killed. That's handled in the drama, which is, after all, a drama. It's not a documentary. Everything that happened in the film happened, but not necessarily in the order and exactly the same. Lionel was killed. He was part of the investigation team that Bert gathered around him, and he was investigating corruption and drugs, and that was even more ferocious than corruption and abortion.
What did you discover about what was going on with abortion?
That the doctors all paid off senior police officers in the homicide squad, and the doctor who had the biggest practice, he paid off the head of the homicide squad. He said that, you know, there's this thing about you get the justice you can afford. Well, that doctor could afford the best. So the role of these police officers was to warn the doctors if there was a complaint, to suppress it, to warn them if there was an impending raid, and to generally, you know, keep business ticking over. And Peggy Berman had the role of being the bag woman. So she collected the money from the doctors and handed it over to the police at the New Boundary Hotel in East Melbourne.
Mm. Played by Susie Porter.
Fabulously by Susie Porter. She does a brilliant job.
She does everything well, I think. Jeremy Sims is absolutely extraordinary.
I nearly fell in love with Jeremy Sims. I thought you were so beautiful.
You did fall in love with Bert. But look, things got very, very dangerous for you, didn't it?
They did.
Very dangerous.
People tried to kill us, and Bert lost his practice because of that, because GPs in those days used to do house calls, and he couldn't take a call at 3 a.m. from somebody who said, "I think I'm having a heart attack," because he could just as well be a setup. And so I learnt, Bert already knew how to protect himself. He was an ex-army man. But I had to learn, and I had to learn to use a gun and look out for snipers and check for gel ignite up the exhaust before I turned on the ignition, and drive on my mirror and all sorts of protective behaviours.
Very powerfully.
In order to survive.
And very powerfully conveyed in the film. Eventually you went on to set up the first clinic in Melbourne that offered abortion on demand, called the Fertility Control Clinic. Go on.
Well, we call it on request because nobody can demand a doctor do anything, really. But, yeah.
Yes, indeed.
Your point is taken, yeah.
What's it like for you watching this telly movie that people will see on Sunday night? It must feel very surreal, sometimes very raw, I would imagine.
Yes. Look, I've watched it a number of times, and I think that helps because it does bring up a lot of anxiety. I still have that lodged in my body. I've still got fear, and I've worked very hard to clear it. Because it meant that I continued to behave in a defensive way in later life, and that was not serving me or anybody else. So I've worked very hard to clear that out. So now it's just really good entertainment. I mean, it's a great movie, and it's a cops and docs, I call it, rather than cops and robbers, and it's a good watch.
Abortion and access to it still divides people, divides women, distresses people. Do you think it will continue to? The precedent set by your campaign together have been very powerful, but nevertheless it remains sort of legally kind of shady in Australia, really. People can access abortion, but it's not clear always what the legal status is.
Well, in Victoria and the ACT, actually, we have excellent legislation, and I'd have to thank Maxine Miranda and Daniel Andrews, the members of Parliament, and Candy Broad, who introduced the Abortion Act that was passed in 2008 in Victoria, and that is a stunning piece of legislation because
it says.
Yeah, it took 40 years for me. Bert, of course, died in 1987, so he didn't get to see that. But it's a stunning piece of legislation that takes abortion out of the Crimes Act, doesn't put it anywhere else. It's now a normal medical procedure that women, discuss with their doctors. The Australian Capital Territory has the same thing. Every other state doesn't. So some states have changed their legislation, but not necessarily to make it as clear as that, to hand the authority to the women who are pregnant, which is where it belongs.
Well, the issue lives on. It will live on, and I think the Tally movie will be very interesting viewing for people, as it has been for you. And, of course, you have become a trailblazer in women's health ever since. Jo Weiner, thank you very much for joining us on Life Matters this morning.
Thanks, Natasha.
Jo Weiner, leading women's health researcher in her own right. Dr. Jo Weiner, and of course Bertram Weiner's widow. That Tally movie on Sunday night at 8:30 p.m. That's the 4th of November on ABC One. But coming up right after the news here on Radio National is Michael Cathcart. Bit of politics in the publishing world.
Well, that's right. Penguin and Random House have got together to create, I'm calling it the giant penguin, but that's not what the world's calling it.
Australia needs a giant penguin.
We need more giant penguins. We do. And we're also going to look at We're going to look at some Palestinian theatre. I've got three performers with me right now in the studio, Natasha, and it's some kids who are learning to play classical music.
Oh, Richard Gill will certainly be tuning in for that one, I hope. Look, thank you, Michael, indeed. And don't forget our meditation challenge. If you head straight to the Life Matters homepage and look on the right-hand side, you'll see all the information. It's running over the next 6 weeks. Why don't you take it and get back to us to see how it goes? Coming up is the 10 a.m. news on RN. Thanks for your company today. Bye for now.